This is Sick Enough, Chapter 12. Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, POTS, and Associated Conditions. Case study, Bella. Bella is a 24-year-old cisgender Latina female with atypical anorexia nervosa. She has been restricting calories since she was 16 years old, with brief periods of better nutrition. Despite her restriction and thoughts constantly consumed by calorie counting and body size, to her dismay, she has never dropped to a weight that feels acceptably low. For a close-knit Mexican family, Bella has felt isolated for years because she has gotten the message from her peers that Latina girls aren't supposed to have eating disorders. For the last 6 months, Bella has worried that she's done something to her heart. It constantly feels like it's beating out of her chest, and it gets much worse when she stands up or moves around. Bella used to overexercise in the service of her eating disorder, but for the last few months, she has neither the energy nor the ability to do so. She has experienced waves of flushing and sweating, and she's noticed itchy rashes on her skin, which look like mosquito bites, then they fade away after an hour or so. Additionally, she's developed headaches that center over her forehead and her cheekbones. 2 months ago, while at work, Bella passed out and was taken to the emergency department. Her lab work was all normal. Her EKG showed a fast heart rate, and she was referred to a cardiologist. The cardiologist thought that she might have developed the postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome, or POTS, and sent her for a tilt table test, which proved inconclusive. However, for the last month, she's had two other episodes of passing out and has felt short of breath and exhausted all the time and has struggled to continue working. Her doctor arranges for her to have a longer-term cardiac recording device implanted. The data reveal that so far, her passing out episodes are always related to a high heart rate, but not to any arrhythmia. She is started on a beta blocker, propranolol, which helps her feel a little better at first, but then she starts feeling short of breath again. The eating disorder, in the meantime, is escalating because that voice in her head can't bear that she's not getting to the gym or able to do any activity at all. Realizing she needs more help and worried that her eating disorder has caused her heart issues, she finds a local therapist who refers her to a dietitian as well. Background. Postural Orthostatic Tachycardia Syndrome, POTS, is diagnosed when a person has experienced at least 6 months of rapid heart rate and other symptoms, like dizziness, shortness of breath, palpitations, nausea, sweating, tremulousness, headaches, anxiety, or range upon standing. It should not be diagnosed when a patient is malnourished, as cardiac findings during malnourishment can mimic POTS. First described in 1893 in a case series on Civil War soldiers. 100 years later, this syndrome was formally defined as POTS. The cause is thought to be an excessive sympathetic response to the pooling of blood when a person stands. The sympathetic nervous system is part of the autonomic nervous system, the system by which our cave person keeps us stable, functioning, and responsive to the world on a daily basis. While our parasympathetic system slows us down as the rest and digest system, our sympathetic system fuels what's commonly known as our fight or flight response. POTS is therefore a form of dysautonomia, referring to when the autonomic nervous system doesn't work. When patients pass out from POTS, syncope in medical terms, it is not from a drop in blood pressure. In fact, patient's postural blood pressure does not typically change that much from sitting to standing in PTOS. Nor are the changes in heart rate from PTOS primarily associated with the hibernating heart changes we see in malnutrition, where patients have a slow resting pulse to conserve calories, but a fast pulse upon walking across the room due to weakened muscles. POTS is generally diagnosed when the heart rate increases more than 30 beats per minute when going from lying down to standing. Alternatively, it is diagnosed when the heart rate goes faster than 120 beats per minute after 10 minutes on a tilt table at 60 to 70 degrees. It more often affects females than males. Some studies have noted that the onset of POTS can follow an infection, leading some to wonder if it represents an autoimmune problem. That is, the body develops antibodies to a disease, which accidentally also attack the autonomic nervous system and thus damage it. In my experience, people who develop POTS tend to have strong mind-body connections. They often have a higher incidence of migraines, IBS, fibromyalgia, and other problems worsened by stress. Sleep issues are common with POTS and thought to be related to body fatigue, chronic pain, or other somatic symptoms. As a result of the unmeasurable comorbid problems someone with POTS might experience, patients can find themselves having their symptoms minimized or doubted by medical professionals. Even though we don't have nearly enough information about exactly how POTS starts, or unfortunately, how optimally to treat the variety of types of POTS, without a doubt, it is a real and potentially devastating disease. Patients as young as their 30s can end up permanently in nursing homes due to POTSs. POTS's debilitating effects, particularly when it presents with chronic fatigue. Three types of POTS. POTS comes in three different types: hyperadrenergic, called hyper-POTS, neuropathic, and hypovolemic. However, these types can overlap. Hyper-POTS occurs when excessive serum levels of norepinephrine, epinephrine, and dopamine are released when patients stand up from a seated position. The cause of this malfunction remains unclear. One theory is that this could be due to a mutation in the norepinephrine reuptake transporter gene. That is, once norepinephrine is released, it doesn't get slurped back into the cell soon enough and it wreaks havoc while it's active. Patients may experience bouts of intense flushing, rage, and sudden onset diarrhea that occur primarily when they stand up for too long. High angiotensin II levels have been noted, worse with low body mass, as an impairment of nitric oxide-mediated vasodilation. It is common to see elevated heart rates at all times, even when laying down, in patients with hyper-POTS, along with elevated blood pressure, pale coloring, exaggerated tremors, anxiety, and cold, sweaty extremities. Neuropathic POTS is associated with partial sympathetic denervation of the lower body, causing impaired vasoconstriction in the lower extremities at the level of the arterial, not the vein. Typically, when someone stands up, gravity makes their blood pool towards their ankles, giving less blood to the heart. Normally, the autonomic nervous system senses this and tightens up the veins and arterioles in the legs, resisting the pooling of blood so that it remains normally distributed throughout the body. When this tightening takes a little more time, such as when you get out of a hot bath that has expanded all your veins, you get lightheaded and feel your heart pounding for a few moments. The heart speeds up to keep pumping that lower blood volume around. Those with neuropathic predominant POTS, however, have trouble tightening up their arterioles when they stand. This subtype impacts more than half of patients with POTS. It is associated with lower resting heart rates, less anxiety and depression, and more acronosis, the cool, bluish hands and feet described in Chapter 2. Hypovolemic POTS refers to patients who appear chronically volume depleted, or in common terms, dehydrated. Usually, dehydration or anemia triggers an increase in our renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system, which keeps us from urinating away fluids to maintain our blood pressure. However, patients with hypovolemic POTS have inappropriately low levels of plasma renin and aldosterone activity and elevated levels of angiotensin II. They don't respond appropriately to normal hydration and dehydration states, and as a result, their pulse rises to compensate. Introducing mast cell activation. Before I turn to treatment of POTS, I'll discuss a few associated conditions. I have learned to ask patients about symptoms of these conditions because this information can make all the difference with regards to treatment strategy that I propose. A remarkable number of my patients, both with and without POTS, have symptoms of a problem called mast cell activation, MCA, also interchangeably called mast cell dysfunction, MCD. The mast cells are a population of white blood cells that contain histamine granules. Histamine is the chemical released in an allergic reaction, causing anything from skin hives to full-blown anaphylaxis. Normally, the mast cells hold on to those histamine granules, except when triggered by an allergen. However, in MCA, the cells are more likely to degranulate or inappropriately release histamine. Patients with MCA describe a range of symptoms, usually including at least several of the following: fleeting rashes that come on suddenly and can disappear as suddenly, hives, which are juicy, soft areas of red swelling on the skin, sinus problems, including pressure and pain, joint pains that come and go, sometimes seemingly in response to specific food groups, abdominal pain after eating, fevers intermittently throughout the day, flushing sensations that are sometimes accompanied by sweating, and escalating reactiveness or even allergies to foods or medications. In severe cases, for reasons that are not well understood, exposure to sunlight and heat can trigger severe mast cell reactions, including formation of edema and a foggy brain. MCA may drive POTS in some cases and can be one of the main causes for the rapid heart rate. Therefore, treating MCA where present should form a foundation of POTS treatment. Treatment of MCA. There are no definitive tests for MCA at present, although some centers use critical criteria that involve testing the urine or blood after flushing or rash episode. When patients process a number of the above symptoms, I tend to treat empirically and see if they feel better on a mast cell stabilizer. If they do, that makes the diagnosis from my perspective. A number of tools in the medical toolbox can be used for treatment. First, one can begin with simple antihistamine medications like ranitidine or famotidine used for reflux, or classic antihistamines like diphenhydramine, loratadine, or cyazine. If these are ineffective by themselves, I add oral mast cell stabilizers. Oral cromolyn is a liquid solution that must be taken 4 times a day to be effective because it is so short-acting. The common starting dose is 10 milligrams or 2 individual vials 4 times a day, and typically it is covered by insurance. The other possible medication is ketoferin, 1 milligram twice a day. Ketoferin is available in prescription eye drops for seasonal allergies, but for some reason, no drug company has picked up its oral formulation. Therefore, it must be prepared in a compounding pharmacy where they can make it into a capsule. Neither of these commonly has any serious side effects, although ketoferin can initially cause some fatigue. While it is not covered by insurance, ketoferin is easier for patients to take as a capsule 2x a day, so I usually start with it instead of oral cromolyn. If patients don't feel markedly better within 2 weeks of starting ketoferin, I discontinue it. If all of these medications fail to adequately control symptoms, I might add the injectable mast cell and basophil stabilizer Omalizumab is an anti-immunoglobulin E, otherwise known as IgE, monoclonal antibody used for a condition called chronic idiopathic urticaria, which also relates to unexplained persistent hives. Felt to be highly effective in this population, as well as seemingly safe during pregnancy, omalizumab is nonetheless not presently evidence-based for MCA. However, exciting research is emerging that IgE may play a key role in autoimmunity, asthma, and perhaps in difficult-to-treat mast cell and basophil disorders. An injected dose of 300 milligram is given monthly. The main side effect is the potential for a serious allergic reaction. Despite MCA causing excess histamine release, I cannot in good conscience recommend a low histamine diet for my patients. It turns out that practically every food can cause histamine release, and the restriction of such a diet is not worth whatever very modest benefit might occur. Such diets are not evidence-based and have the potential to be triggering for someone with an eating disorder. Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. The other condition associated with POTS and MCA is Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, EDS. EDS is an inherited collagen disorder with various subtypes. Patients can have issues with their skin, joints, and vascular. They are hyperflexible and suffer from frequent joint dislocations, headaches, taste and smell dysregulation, and other issues. Genetic testing is available, although it is not commonly done, as patients may find several year waiting lists to see a geneticist who specializes in EDS. Patients can be perceived as too somatic or too difficult when they have EDS, because there are so many physical effects from this condition. Once again, this is a case of Western medicine dismissing patients who suffer physically without clear testing to show why they suffer. future research will likely bring more answers. EDS has been associated with MCA and eating disorders. The theory is that abnormalities in the GI system and in taste and smell, as well as perhaps the anxiety produced by constant pain and joint dislocations, may set a patient up for abnormal eating and psychological stress. It is clear that we learn more about the physical effects of complicated syndromes like EDS, MCA, and POTS, and will serve patients far better. Essential treatment for all types of POTS. Because we still simply don't know enough about the subtle, difficult to measure physiology taking place, treatment of POTS at present can be difficult. However, there are some important treatment considerations that can usually improve POTS symptoms, even if they do not cure it altogether. I often start by setting expectations with newly diagnosed patients that this may be a chronic, relapsing, and remitting problem. It can take years to get POTS under control, and there will invariably be flares. Unfortunately, some patients have a relatively mild version of POTS and respond well to treatments, while others have an exceptionally severe version and seem to have far more side effects than they do benefits from the standard care protocols. Once again, there is no way to predict this at the time of clinical diagnosis. Studies of adolescents with POTS show good outcomes overall by 2 to 10 years from diagnosis. Patients' open communication, compassion, and a willingness to keep trying different treatment modalities are all vital for POTS treatment. POTS treatment always starts with volume expansion, which means consistent hydration. Good salt and fluid intake throughout the day are vital in all types of POTS. As a marker of adequate hydration, the urine should be almost clear after the first morning void. Intravenous hydration should be avoided, including some infusions via a port, except in the context of serious intercurrent illness, like a diarrheal virus that causes significant dehydration, or chronic debilitating symptoms that are clearly helped by IV fluids. Additionally, good sleep is vital, although accomplishing recharging rest may prove difficult. Exercise may help those with POTS, such as a recumbent bike or other exercise that does not provoke postural symptoms. However, patients with POTS may also have chronic fatigue, which makes the POTS both more severe and more treatment refractory. This is once again a clinical diagnosis. In those with POTS and chronic fatigue, exercise will typically worsen all symptoms. Medications to treat POTS. After these standard interventions, we turn to the medications used for POTS. Patients can have very different responses to medication, both positive and negative, so it's important to set expectations that various month-long trials may be indicated. For patients with hyper-POTS who have any symptoms at all of MCA, I always try to optimize MCA treatment first. Then, for the POTS itself, I usually start methyl dopa twice a day. Methyl dopa is an old blood pressure medicine in the alpha-2 agonist class. If this is insufficient after a month, but has helped a little, I will add another medicine with alpha-2 agonist activity, a clonidine patch of 0.1 milligram weekly. Clonidine, a medicine that also relaxes blood vessels, can help the heart beat more slowly. Side effects for both include low blood pressure symptoms, so patients should take it easy when moving from lying down to standing up. If patients develop shortness of breath or actual low blood oxygen levels while on clonidine, I stop the medication. For those with neurogenic POTS and hypovolemic POTS, I might start propranolol or labetalol, both beta blockers. These specifically slow down the heart rate and can also reduce blood pressure. Low-dose propranolol, 20 mg a day, has been found to improve symptoms and have few negative effects in adults with POTS. Labetalol can be started at a low dose and slowly increased until patients feel better but don't have side effects of low blood pressure. Beta blockers should not be used in those with hyper-POTS. My clinical experience is that it causes worsened shortness of breath and even low blood oxygen levels. My theory is that it may exacerbate imbalances in the oxygenation blood flow to the lungs, called V/Q mismatch. I've seen patients enter my practice already on a beta blocker and home oxygen at night and be able to stop the home oxygen when they stop the beta blocker. Midodrine is an alpha-1 agonist used for those with low blood pressure. It can be effective in individuals with neurogenic POTS, but it can cause high blood pressure, and I haven't had as much success with it in my patients. Similarly, I generally recommend against an oral steroid called fludrocortisone. Although used to help boost hydration levels, it often causes water retention, can cause cataracts when used long-term, and just isn't well-tolerated by patients. Chronic fatigue and POTS. My heart goes out to patients who have the combination of POTS and chronic fatigue. A once highly active, organized multitasker can be halted in her tracks, barely able to get out of bed to play with her kids for an hour or two a day. Just taking a shower can require hours of rest afterwards. For these patients, modafinil in a weak dopamine reuptake inhibitor that is used to improve wakefulness. Effective for the highly fatiguing effects of cancer, HIV, shift work sleep disorder, and depression, it's administered as 100 mg by mouth daily. My experience is that this can be a game changer for those with POTS and chronic fatigue. Managing syncope, fainting, passing out. I'll end the section on POTS with a brief note about managing syncope, which is also known as fainting or passing out. Syncope occurs when the brain doesn't get enough blood for whatever reason. Passing out is Mother Nature's brilliant way of getting blood to our brain, essentially forcing us to get down on the ground and get our brain even with our heart. Patients may have a set of symptoms referred to as a prodrome that signals that they are about to pass out. Tunnel vision, seeing spots, nausea, sweatiness, ringing in the ears, shortness of breath, and shakiness are all common. When a patient gets these prodromal symptoms, they should listen to them. The brain wants more blood. Patients should immediately get their brains even with or below their hearts. The best posture is to lie down flat with the legs up. This dumps blood from the legs back into the central vascular, back into the heart, and then up to the brain. Short of that, sitting down and putting the head between the knees works well too. Patients should stay in that position until they feel all the way better. Sitting up and going back about life too quickly can cause patients to pass out, which risks hitting their head or harming some other part of their body. Drop attacks or new onset syncope episodes without any warning may result from something different and more dangerous, and always merit intermediate medical workup. Case resolution, Bella. Bella's therapist and dietitian are a good match for her. They focus not only on her eating disorder, but also on the challenges of being a Latina woman with an eating disorder. Bella feels seen and heard and makes progress. Bella's doctor learns about her worsening short of breath and recommends she buy an oxygen monitor. This shows that her blood oxygen level is falling below normal at intervals throughout the day. She stops Bella's propranolol and, after doing some more reading about POTS, recognizes that Bella may have hyper-POTS as well as MCA, causing the itchy rash, sinus pressure, and flushing episodes. Bella starts on ketoferin and methodalpia, and within a month, she feels some improvements. She no longer feels totally depleted of energy, and her mast cell symptoms are gone. She and her doctor talk about overall good self-care being vital for her POTS, and this helps motivate her in her eating disorder recovery work, too. She knows that good nutrition and rest will guarantee freedom from POTS symptoms, but engaging in her eating disorder will guarantee worse fatigue, higher risk for passing out, and overall body pain. Bearing witness. Sometimes in caring for patients who have unmeasurable medical problems, I come to the point where they are still suffering and I don't have a next solution to offer. In this case, the ancient role of the physician once again proves relevant. I can bear witness. I can hold space for my patient's suffering without getting impatient, distressed, or overwhelmed. Family and friends may struggle to stay compassionate while seeing their loved one in pain, exhausted, or failing to improve despite countless doctors and tests. The doctor, however, occupies the sacred space of both caring about the patient and yet possessing the neutrality of a non-family member to sit with and welcome further discussion of symptoms. I promise my patients in these moments that I will continue to walk with them on this journey of finding answers and relief of symptoms. I will continue to read the literature and talk with experts to learn about new treatment modalities. I will welcome their own research without ego and will read anything they send me carefully and with a scientist's eye because no one is more motivated than they to find solutions. In a modern medical world where practicality, miraculous diagnosis, and therapeutic solutions abound, it can be excruciating to tell a patient that I'm not sure what to do next. However, I can name my instinct to jump in and try multiple treatments at once, hoping to make them feel better. I can name that this instinct poses a risk of causing harm. I can set expectations, both with my patient and with myself, that will help make thoughtful, evidence-based decisions together, keeping the treatment momentum up while not rushing. And I can bear witness. That concludes the reading of Sick Enough, Chapter 12, POTS and Associated Conditions.